We're really happy to have Doug Sparks here again. As always, we just love to have him come. He's going to speak a garden epiphany. Almost couldn't say that word. at this gathering. And then this afternoon, we're having a workshop from 1 to 4. And he's going to speak on A Dream of Trees. Should be wonderful. Thank you so much for coming. Oh, we really appreciate it. I just have a few announcements. September 14th through 16th, Scott Killaby will be here. There's flyers out there. Friday night is free for anyone who wants to come and meet him, etc. And then decide if you'd like to come on Saturday and Sunday. Let's see. I'm doing this by... We didn't get announcements, so I'm doing it by memory. Susan Dugan is doing a forgiveness class on October 6th, which is a Saturday. $30. Need to pre-register with her. And again, the flyers are out there, so you can get her email or her telephone number, or you can write us at the center, and we'll pass it on. Hers is from 10 to 3:30 with an hour and a half for lunch, I think. It's on Forgiveness 101 Workshop. The picnic is the 7th. Is that right? Or 9th. 9th. So please join us. Hot dogs, brats, etc. will be provided. Bring your favorite dish. And we will also be providing the drinks, etc. And it will be after the gathering. So we welcome all of you to come. We'd love to have as many as possible. We always have fun. And Francis is our new gardener wherever he went. I'm surprised he's not in this room. But anyway, he's making our backyard so beautiful that it'll be a fun time, I think. It always is. Do we have anybody here for the first time today? No?
Hello.
Oh.
Hi.
I'm Matt.
You're Matt. Welcome, Matt. Welcome. Anybody else? Okay, with that. Thank you, Doug.
Oh, you're welcome.
Great job.
I have to have notes myself. So the talk today is really about the importance of personal experience, of converting your understanding of A Course in Miracles, the intellectual part, the part that you glean from reading and studying the course, converting that into experience. And I titled the talk Garden Epiphany because the time that I was thinking about what to do this workshop on, my wife Nisa, who's a gardener, and had this experience out in the garden, which I will relate to you in just a little bit. And then about a month or a month and a half after that, I had another experience of my own, which was hardly an epiphany, but it illustrates very well that all kinds of different experiences can be ways of internalizing the course, of making the Course in Miracles part of your own personal attitude. So what we're really talking about here is the process of converting your understanding of A Course in Miracles to your practice of the Course in Miracles. And so that's the intention of the thrust of this talk this morning. And of course, that's the challenge for all of us. I mean, it's a challenge just to get the basics in terms of understanding the course at first. But as you do this through the years, what typically happens for most students is that the course becomes simpler and simpler. Until one day it dawns on us, as after we've been doing this for a number of years for most of us, how simple this course really is, how black and white it is, too, in terms of the ease of practicing this course once you really grasp how simple it actually is. But nearly all of us, certainly myself, have to go through a fairly long period of thinking that the course is more complicated than it is. The language, of course, is quite lofty, and it takes us a little while to come to understand the symbolism of just the words. And it takes us longer than that to realize that our experience in the world, all of it, is an outpicturing of our attitude. It's an outpicturing of the inward condition, the Course says. We'll read that in just a little bit. Matt, do you have much experience with the Course? Do you have any background with the Course, or is this your first introduction to it?
This is not my first introduction, but I'd say I've
Oh, okay. I'll try to simplify some of the things that I'm saying, just in the simplest bare bones way possible.
The concepts themselves aren't new to me.
Yeah. Okay. What the course is really saying, in a nutshell, is that we include everyone in our sphere of caring, what the course calls the circle of atonement. Atonement's a big word that the course uses, but all it really means is the correction for the perception that we're all separate and that we all have separate interests. And so the course says that the sole responsibility of the miracle worker, and the miracle worker is simply someone who's studying this and trying to use it as their path, that the sole responsibility of the miracle worker is to accept the atonement for himself, which means to learn to bring everyone into inclusion with oneself, to see everyone else the way you see yourself, in spite of the obvious differences at the level of form in the world. Obviously, no two of us, even twins, are alike at the level of form in the world. We don't look alike, we don't have the same background, we don't come from the same places, we're not genetically the same. At the level of form, at the level of the body, none of us is the same. But the Course emphasizes that at the level of mind, which is the only level the Course cares about, because that's the level of cause, of course, the Course says about itself, this is a course in cause and not effect. And the cause is the mind. And so in the Course's metaphysics, it presents the idea that we are actually a mind dreaming a world, and that our reality is as mind, and that mind is abstract and non-specific. As the physicists say, it's non-local, non-temporal. And that this mind, which has no physicality, again, it's abstract, this mind is dreaming physicality, is dreaming bodies, is dreaming my body, your body, and the world, and the universe, for that matter. And so the cause of everything is the mind. And so the course says about itself that this is a course in mind training. And the course, practically on every page throughout all of the three books and the pamphlets, refers to you, Y-O-U. And that you that it's talking to is not Matt. It's not Doug. It's not the individual person. It's you as a mind. And that mind has the capacity to decide between inclusion of everyone or exclusion. And if you exclude anyone, you exclude yourself in the process from oneness. And so the idea in practicing this course is to become more and more and more inclusive. And of course, all of us pick and choose as we go through this process who we're willing to include and who we're not. And when we begin, the list of those that are not included, if you're anything like me, is quite long. But as you begin to study and begin to apply the principles that this course teaches, of course, what happens is that you begin to realize the price that you pay for that exclusion. And after I get through talking about Nisa's garden epiphany, I'm going to talk about my own experience, which was, again, not an epiphany, but it certainly was a very visceral experience of me, for me, of the price that one pays for exclusion. Having said that, I'll tell you about the Garden Epiphany, and then we'll kind of take it from there. And again, the experiences that each of us have in the world are not important in and of themselves. What's important is what they stand for, is the source that they come from. And the source that every experience comes from is one of two sources. The Course uses the terminology, the Holy Spirit or Jesus, for the source of inclusion, the source of love. And those are just symbols. And they stand for something, not themselves. And what they stand for is the love of God. And that love is abstract. And again, we can experience its reflections in this world, but this world, as the Course teaches, was made as an attack on God. It's an attempt to separate ourselves from God and to have an experience of a place, of a world, where God is not invited. And this world is that experience. And all of our experiences in the world arise from that wish to be separate. And again, the wish arises in this mind that I'm talking about, which is abstract. It's non-temporal, non-local. And it's dreaming time and space. If that seems like an odd idea to you, let me just simply remind you of your nighttime dreams, where you do this every single night. You go to bed, you fall asleep, a veil of forgetfulness falls across your mind, and you no longer remember that you're in bed asleep, and your mind begins to dream. And what your mind is doing when it dreams is spinning out symbology that stands for something in for you. There's a section in chapter 18 where this is discussed in great detail. It's called The Basis of the Dream. And I would urge all of you to reread that anytime that you find that you're having a hard time thinking about the fact that the mind is simply symbolizing and that the world that you live in isn't really solid and concrete like you think it is. It's actually just the mind symbolizing for itself. So you go to bed at night, you fall asleep, this veil of forgetfulness falls across your mind, you no longer remember that you went to bed and fell asleep, and as your mind begins to dream, you experience yourself as the figure in the dream. You're actually asleep in bed, but in your dream, you're out doing things somewhere in a world that your mind has now made up. There is no world while you're asleep at night in your mind. You're simply dreaming it. You're not out in a place with other people and other situations and circumstances doing things. You're asleep in bed. But your mind is giving you the experience that you're out and about doing something, having some experience. And of course, your experience while you dream is that the figures in your dream with you and the situations and the circumstances are causing you to have an experience. So for example, you dream that you're out for a walk and it starts raining. And then you feel cold and you feel wet. And it seems to you that it's your body that tells you, this body that you think you are in the dream, that your body is telling you that it's raining, that it's getting cloudy, it's getting colder, and you're having this experience because it's raining and because it's cloudy and because it's getting colder. And within the context of the dream, it seems to you that your body is what's telling you all of this is happening. But there is no body. There's only the dream of a body. And there is no rain. And there are no clouds. And it's not getting dark. Your mind is simply spinning all of this out. And you're having the experience that an outer world in your dreams is causing you to have all of these experiences. But that is not the case at all. What the Course says about this, after explaining our nighttime dreams, is that all of your time is spent in dreaming. That your nighttime dreams and your daytime dreams are exactly the same. Only the form is different. The content remains the same. And what it means by that is that the form seems different in your nighttime dreams and your daytime dreams because you can fly in your dreams, you can be in your childhood home, and then you can be in your office, then you can be in your home, all in a sequence of a very short time span. And you don't see any indiscrepancies there. You don't see any inconsistencies there while you're dreaming. In your daytime dreams, that seems much more linear and much more concrete. But the Course is saying all of our time is spent in dreaming. The form is different because you can jump around in nighttime dreams more than you can in daytime dreams. But that the content remains the same. And when the Course talks about content, it's talking about this mind that I've been telling you about. And the content is our that remains the same is our insane wish to have our little visceral temper tantrums acted out. As the Course says, we literally scream, "I want it thus." And so we wanted to be separate from God, we wanted to be on our own, and this world is our experience of the expression of that wish. And so in our nighttime dreams, it seems to us that in the example that I was giving, that the rain was making us cold. But it was we ourselves as a dreaming mind that was making ourselves cold. No body told us we were cold. Our own body did not tell us we were cold. The mind simply dreamt that the body got wet and told us we were cold. And again, what the Course is saying to us in terms of its basic metaphysics is that that's what's going on right here, right now. It seems like there's a body over here blithering away talking to you, and that you're all sitting over there trying to comprehend what in the world he's talking about. That's not what's going on. One mind is dreaming all of this dream. And just like in your nighttime dreams, that one mind has divided itself up into all of these seemingly different characters that seem to impinge upon one another and cause one another to have experiences. But it's, again, one mind doing it all. And so we're all connected to that one mind. And so at the level of content, we're all the same. Each one of us is experiencing ourselves as an individual in a world of separated individuals, each of us on our own, trying to do the best we can to keep on keeping on here in the world. But in truth, it's just one mind dreaming that we're all separate. And so, in fact, we're still all a part of that one mind. And the way the Course expresses this is it says, ideas leave not their source, which means that the idea of being a separated individual has not packed its bags and left that mind and gone out and made up a world that's actually out there where things actually happen. Now, the Course does a very kind thing with us about this metaphysical principle. It tells us that this is the fact of the matter, that this is what's actually happening, but it tells us, don't you try and pretend that you really believe that this is true in terms of your experience when you begin this course, because you'd be lying to yourself if you do that. You'd be kidding yourself, and you'd be setting yourself up to be foolish. For us, the world seems real because we've made the world real for ourselves by our wish to have it be real. And so what that means is that we are the sole power, we as a mind, as a decision-making mind that can choose, as I was saying before, inclusion or exclusion, that can choose to listen to the voice of love or the voice of separation. We as a decision-making mind have all of the power in the world. Jesus has no power, God has no power, the Holy Spirit has no power, the ego has no power in the world. We have all of the power in terms of which of those symbols we choose for our teacher. And so all of the power in heaven and earth is vested in us as a decision-making mind. We like to pretend that we're these weak, puny, powerless little figures that can hardly keep ourselves alive, let alone make any really important differences for ourselves. On the contrary, we have all of the power in the world because we have the power to choose which voice, which teacher to listen to as a mind. And this other teacher, who is symbolized by the figure of Jesus or the Holy Spirit, this other teacher lives in our mind in a place that the Course calls the right mind. So it gives a picture of this mind as divided into three parts. There's the right mind, which is the home of Jesus or the Holy Spirit, the home of love. There's the wrong mind, which is the home of the ego, which is the voice for separation and specialness. I'm on my own and I like it. Thank you very much. And then there's the part of the mind that gets to choose which one of these voices to listen to. Now, the default setting in everybody's mind as an individual is the ego, and that's what runs until we interrupt it. And so each of us operates thinking that I, and my experience in the world is that I, as Doug, an individual person with an individual body, decides for himself what to do. But what's actually going on, of course, is that I'm listening to the voice of the ego that's saying, you are an individual, and this is really a great thing. We've gotten out from underneath the yoke of God. We can do what we damn well please. So let's get out there and have some fun. Let's get out there and get what we want. Let's get out there and use the world to make ourselves happy, satisfied, fulfilled, and complete. Most of us here, as I look around the room, look like you're at least getting along towards as old as I am by now. And so most of you have probably had the experience that this is easier said than done. The apple out there on the end of the string that's on the stick that comes out from our own head seems to move away every time that we try to reach out and grab it. And of course, the apple is just a symbol for all of those things in the world that we want to take a bite out of. And the apple moves every time we do. And the satisfaction never seems complete. And so, after having had enough of that experience, we begin to mature enough to begin to wonder if there couldn't be a better way than the way that I'm proceeding. And the Course is offered to us as that other way. So, I hope that lays enough groundwork for you to talk about how we're all one here. Because we're really all one in the sense that we have this same model of mind that we all operate from. We can choose the wrong mind, which is the selfish self, the one that we all know so well. We can choose the right mind, which is the home of the Holy Spirit or Jesus or God or love or whatever symbol you like. And believe me, Jesus doesn't care what symbols you use. He makes himself so evident in the Course so that we can get over all of our grievances about him, all of the terrible things that we've made up about him that are not true. He presents himself to us simply as an older brother with more experience who can show us how to find our way to happiness. But he does not demand that you use him as a symbol. But he does suggest that you better work your way through the objections that you have to him, because those objections are an impediment to your finding happiness. As long as you're holding a grievance against Jesus or any other symbol, what you're saying is, it's not my fault, it's their fault. I was misguided. My Catholic upbringing, my Jewish upbringing, my atheistic upbringing, all of that caused me to be unhappy. The way my parents treated me, the fact that I'm not 6'2", I'm only 5'7½". I was going to be a big guy, and now I'm not. And that's why I'm not happy. I was going to be a smart guy, and now I'm not. We blame everything on something outside of ourselves. And so this Course is a way of gradually taking back responsibility and realizing truly that all of the power in heaven and earth is invested in my ability to choose which teacher I listen to. And if I listen to the teacher of happiness, I will be taught gently, kindly, slowly, at my own pace, how to move away from this tortured existence as a separated individual to a much more peaceful, much more quiet, much more inclusive experience of myself as someone who spontaneously, because it's good for me, chooses to see everyone else's interest as the same as my own. So, back to the Garden Epiphany. So, Nisa, how many of you here are gardeners or have a yard that you take care of in any way, whether it's mowing grass or doing stuff like that? Well, you'll all appreciate, all of you who raised your hands will appreciate, as probably everyone who's been here all summer will appreciate, what a hot summer it's been. And, oh, that's fine. Thank you. That's good. That's good. Don't go away. I'll be alone. So you can appreciate what a hot summer it's been. And my wife, Nisa, with a teeny tiny bit of help from me over the last 4 or 5 years, have been installing and developing a garden. This summer has been the first really, really hot summer that we've had without much rain and with so many 90-degree-plus days. So Nisa was out there a couple of months ago in the middle of all of this heat, gardening one afternoon, early evening, and as she had been for quite a number of weeks, was noticing once again how much many of the plants in the garden were struggling and how they were efforting just to survive, and how she, in connection with this gardening, was efforting herself to try and get this garden to survive and to make it through the heat. And in noticing that all of the plants were suffering and that she was suffering as well, it dawned on her that she and the garden were extensions of one another. She was simply the mobile part of the garden, and that and that as the caretaker of the garden, that she just fulfilled a particular role in the garden, but that what was going on with the garden and what was going on with her were connected, and they were connected in her experience. Now, we all know that we're connected to everything as an intellectual idea, but to get that at the visceral level is what I'm talking about here in terms of its importance to us. Now, that Nisa had this experience is important for Nisa. It's important to the rest of us in terms of learning that we too want to be alert for noticing when principles of the Course in Miracles present themselves to us in our day-to-day lives here in the world. Because it's in making the connection between the ideas that the Course is giving to us and applying them to our lives in the world that we begin to make sense of it all. And that the Course really comes home to roost for us. That is, it becomes useful for us as a tool. You can have the most beautiful, most lofty, most wonderful, most kind, most loving, most inclusive ideas in the whole world, and understand them intellectually, but that doesn't do you any good until you can convert that to your own experience. When that becomes your own experience, it then becomes yours truly. And it's then you're much more highly motivated to keep applying these principles because you notice the difference in your experience. So here's Nisa in the garden experiencing how the garden is struggling and how she's struggling. And as a result of this, Nisa realizes that she needs to put more thought into planning what she plants in this garden. What kind of plants are used to this kind of climate? What kind of things grow in Pueblo, in New Mexico, in Arizona? Because that's the kind of climate that we're having here in Colorado now. And so we want to put the kinds of things in the garden that are acclimated to this kind of environment so that they thrive and do not have to struggle. And so that Nisa will be able to thrive as a gardener and not have to struggle with trying to keep plants alive that are not adapted and not suited to a real hot Colorado climate. So this insight for her then opened up a whole thing of the connectedness to everything. She realized she's connected to the garden. She realizes she's connected to how she thinks about everything because her thoughts about the garden were filled with effort and stress, and so she was experiencing effort and stress. And so she was able to do what the Course calls generalize the lesson, to realize, oh, this doesn't just apply to my relationship with the garden, it applies to my relationship with Doug, my relationship with my house, my relationship with my car, my relationship with the neighbors, my relationship with the city, my relationship with everything. And so the lesson became important for her, both in terms of the garden and what that meant for her, but more importantly in terms of generalizing the lesson so that you begin to see, oh, I am connected to everything. That's not just a cute, sweet, lovely little idea. That's a really important thing to get viscerally because the way that I think about everyone else is going to be the kind of thinking that I experience. And so if I'm thinking, you know, begrudging thoughts, judgmental thoughts, angry thoughts, irritated thoughts about somebody, what am I experiencing? I'm experiencing anger, irritation, judgment, separation. I'm experiencing myself as isolated from all of these people and things that I'm having these thoughts about. Conversely, if I'm thinking kindly about others, if I'm thinking inclusively about others, if I'm thinking, what's going on for this person? They're afraid just like I am. Then what am I experiencing? I'm experiencing inclusion. I'm experiencing not being separated. I'm experiencing being the same as these other people. And so the way that we choose to think about people primarily, but things as well, is critical for us in terms of our experience of our life here in this world. And of course, before you can leave this world behind, you have to make this world a soft, gentle place for yourself. And only you can do that. Jesus can't do that for you. God can't do that for you. I can't do that for you. Only you can do that for you. The people who love you and adore you the most cannot do this for you. Only you can do it. because it's only you that has the power to choose how you look at the world that seems to be outside of your mind. And again, I say seems to be outside because what the Course again is teaching us is that I'm a mind dreaming a world. And so the Course says at one place, dream softly of your sinless brothers who unite with you in holiness. So, yes.
So I'm still confused. Let's say there's 40 people in this room. Are there 40 dreams going on, or is there one dream that we're all participating in?
There's one dream that we're all participating in, and we're each seeing it from a particular perspective. It's like each one of us is an aspect of the dream, and we each see it from that particular perspective. So, just in terms of the physicality of this room, I'm sitting over here looking this way, you're sitting over there looking this way, so you see the room physically differently than I do. But we're looking at the same room, which means that we're really looking at the same dream from a different perspective. It's just the capacity that the mind has to divide itself up into seemingly different characters. It's one mind that divides itself up. So in terms of understanding this, think again of your nighttime dreams and how there's one you that falls asleep at night. But that one you dreams countless characters and has dreamt countless characters in your lifetime. Millions, if not billions, of different characters. Trees, cars, people, weather, all kinds of different things. That one mind conjured up all of these seemingly different things and people. Does that clarify?
Yeah, well, the next question is then how do we change anything? If we're just participants watching this big thing take place, how do we help ourselves?
You help yourself by changing your attitude towards what you're looking at from one of I'm separate and on my own to one of we're all in this together. So that I recognize that the way I think of you is going to be the experience that I have. And if I think of you kindly, I'm going to experience kindness. If I think of you judgmentally, I'm going to experience judgment and separation. And so it's just for me that I'm doing this. It will be a kindness towards you, but it's really Jesus appeals to our selfishness to try to get us to recognize that to include you is the kindest thing that I can do for me. So it's not for you that I do it, it's for me that I do it. And then I realize that, oh, but I feel a lot better when I do it for you too. If I take it upon myself, if I choose as a mind, as I seem to choose as an individual named Doug, to include you, to think about you the way I think about myself, I feel better. And so why wouldn't I do that all the time? Why do I keep wanting to be special and exclude you as if I were somehow above you or better than you or different than you? Yes, I'm different at the level of form than you, but at the level of mind, I'm exactly the same. And what I choose as a teacher, which teacher I choose, what attitude I choose, one of inclusion or exclusion, is what I'm going to experience. And so it behooves me to practice inclusion, to practice kindness, to practice what the Course calls forgiveness. And forgiveness in the Course in Miracles is simply taking back my projections, my judgments. I'm realizing I'm not upset about you. I'm upset about my judgment about you. You can do whatever you do, and I don't have to be upset at all. I choose to be upset because I want to delude myself into thinking that I don't have all of the power in the universe, that I'm powerless, and that it's your fault that I'm unhappy, or it's you that I have to thank for being happy, when in fact, it's only me. But I don't want that responsibility. Because I think that with that responsibility comes punishment. Because I made what I think is a horrible choice, which was to leave God and to come into this world. And I think that I'm going to be punished for that. So does that clarify that word? Okay. Did I confuse anyone with that little detour there? Okay. So that was Nisa's experience, and again, it's not important except to Nisa that Nisa had that experience, and the only reason that I bring it up is because it's an example of how important experience is for us. It's where the rubber hits the road in terms of applying this course to our lives in the world. Now, my experience was a completely different form of an experience. I was in traffic, the traffic that I'm always talking to you about. I wasn't watching football this time, at least. I was in traffic, and someone cut me off. There's a place in Boulder where there's a big shopping center, and there's an exit that comes out of the shopping center. The road is 5 lanes wide where this exit comes out of the shopping center, but it's right before a traffic light. And when the traffic light, when there's much traffic in there, is much traffic in Boulder these days, when there's much traffic in Boulder anytime during the day, you can't pull out of this exit and get in any lane except the immediate lane, which turns right in about 50 yards. So people pull out of there and don't want to have to turn right and go the wrong way. They want to get over a lane or two or all the way over into the left turn lane within this 25 or 30 yards so that they don't have to go out of their way to get going the direction they want. So a woman had pulled out into this lane. I was in this lane because I wanted to turn right and I was coming up the street. And she pulled out and, of course, and unless somebody lets you in, you can't get into these other lanes. And the light had turned red, so she couldn't get in. So I pulled up, and I just waved to her and asked her, would she back up so that I could go through, and then she could pull back out. And she gave me the finger. I took umbrage at that. And I completely forgot that this was another child of God in this other car. Only momentarily. So the light changed and nobody let her in, and so she sat there and the light turned red again, and so we're still sitting there, and I'm not happy now at all. And by now somebody's pulled up behind her, so she can't back up, so she can't let me through. And so I fume all the way through the other light, and when the light changes, somebody finally lets her in, and when they do, I just sit on the horn. And, of course, she gives me the finger again.
Did the B word come to mind?
I tell you, forgiveness did not come to mind. So I was very, very angry about this. And the amusing part of this retrospectively was I watched myself choose to get angry at her. I literally remember going, well, I can wait. I'm not in a hurry. But who the hell does she think she is pulling out there just sitting there? Like, you know, so I'm going back and forth. Now, and then once I honked the horn, of course, then I committed fully to the ego. Of course, my reaction to the reaction that I got from her was fully my ego, too. But the part about this that's significant is that I was so angry about this that I was viscerally upset for hours afterwards. I mean, I literally felt sick for 2 or 3 hours afterwards. I just couldn't get my mind off of this. And I kept going, well, you didn't have to get so upset about that, Doug. Yeah, but that. She had no right to do that. Yeah, but you could. You're not in a hurry. Where were you going? Yeah, but she still didn't have any right. And in the meantime, I'm literally feeling sick to my stomach. Like I hadn't eaten in quite a while, and I got home and I really wasn't hungry. Just so upset. So anyway, the point of all of this is that was enough. That was enough is enough for Doug. Finally. Of getting mad in traffic that I haven't gotten mad since. I really catch myself right away going, oh no, I'm not going there. Because I didn't like the way I felt at all. And I was fully cognizant of doing it to myself. I mean, I've been doing this course so long now, damn it all, that I really can't get away with blaming for very long. You know, I can do it for a few seconds or a few minutes.
Can't you blame the course for not letting you?
Yeah, good idea. Good idea. Excellent. Yeah, damn course. So I knew I did it to myself. And so I watch myself, know that I've done it myself, and then go back to this woman. And then know I chose that, and then go back to this woman. And then remember that was such a silly mistake, you know, and it felt a lot heavier than just a silly mistake. So I had to work my way back through being heavy-handed with myself about being stupid, you know, about making such a foolish choice. Now, as you know, those of you who've heard me talk before, you know I tell these stories on myself all the time. I'm always doing these kinds of things, and presumably most of us are. And I always give you the advice, don't be heavy-handed with yourself about this. You know, try to smile at being silly. You know, try to come back to laughing at yourself about this as soon as you can. You know, well, that day I couldn't get back to being lighthearted about it or seeing that as just a silly, trivial little thing to have done. I literally felt sick, as I said. So that's sometimes what it takes for us to learn our lessons of forgiveness, to learn to choose the right teacher immediately rather than to choose the wrong teacher and then have to go through all of that backtracking that one has to do. I'm literally still mildly embarrassed when I think of this woman. If I had to see her, I would be embarrassed. I wouldn't want to lecture her about cutting me off. I'd want to apologize about having been so heavy-handed with her. Because she's just doing whatever she's doing. You know, she's trying to get home to take care of the kids or fix dinner or go to the next mall to shop some more or whatever she was doing. It doesn't matter what she was doing. What matters was my reaction. And what matters metaphysically was, this is my dream. Not Doug's dream, but who I really am as the dreamer of the dream, not Doug the figure in the dream, but as the mind that is the dreamer of the dream, it's my dream. So if it's my dream, if this were a nighttime dream, if this had been a nighttime dream that I just described for you, who would I be mad at? And if our nighttime dreams and our daytime dreams are exactly the same, and the Course says that in no uncertain terms, all of your time is spent in dreaming. If that's the case, who am I mad at? Well, there's no one that I'm mad at except myself, but I can't tolerate being mad at myself, and so I project it. And projection is always projection of causality. If you want to take a handy little ditty away from this class with you, recognize that projection is always the projecting out, the displacing outward from the mind, causality. It's not my fault. It's the woman in the other car's fault. It's the rainy weather's fault. It's the Broncos' fault. It's somebody's fault, but it's not my fault. But if I'm the dreamer of the world of dreams and no other cause it has nor ever will, that's a quote from the Course, I am the dreamer of the world of dreams, no other cause it has nor ever will, then there is no one else to blame. And so my blaming this woman in the car is nonsense. It's insanity. And it's projection of causality. I'm saying the cause of my anger was not my choosing anger. It was what this woman did. That's a bold-faced lie. I knew it when I did it, but I did it anyway because I wanted the guilt to rest on her. And that shows you that if I can be conscious of what I'm doing and still want to do it, still feel the urge to do it, how invested we are in projection. Jet means to throw outward. Pro means forward. So it just means to throw it forward. Throw it out of the mind and into the world. Causality. The world has no power to cause me to have any kind of experience anywhere ever. Because I'm the dreamer of my dream as a mind. Doug, as a body and a person and a personality in the world, is what the Course calls a figure in the dream. It has no power. It's a puppet. It does nothing. It has no volition. It does not choose. The mind chooses. And again, if that seems odd to you, just think of your nighttime dreams, because that's what you do in your nighttime dreams. You dream a you who doesn't exist in a world that doesn't exist, in time and space that doesn't exist. Our daytime dreams are exactly the same. We dream a person, a me, who doesn't exist in time and space that doesn't exist, in a world that doesn't exist, in a universe that doesn't exist, but is simply the stuff of dreams. And so what we want to do, to come back to your question of how do we get out of this, is we want to use the dream on behalf of awakening. And the way that we use the dream on behalf of awakening is to remember that I choose which way to look at the dream. That is, I choose which teacher to reference to interpret the dream. And so Jesus, yes, Lillian.
But then you just said, like, it's not I, the figure in the dream that chooses.
Right.
It's the decision maker, it's the mind that chooses.
Right.
And, well, we can remember to ask, you know, the Holy Spirit choose for God for us. But that doesn't mean that we are going to experience the results of that choice when we ask, because we don't know when the mind is really going to make that choice.
What you describe is everyone's experience as we practice this course. But the fact of the matter is, there is no Lillian.
Yes.
The mind is only dreaming Lillian, and is only dreaming that Lillian's only going to experience it herself as a mind if the mind chooses it. But it's the mind that's choosing to experience itself as Lillian rather than as a mind. So Lillian is the gateway for you back to the mind, just as Doug is the gateway for Doug back to the mind. So I've got to remember that I'm a decision maker, and I choose. Doug doesn't choose. I, as a decision maker, who is who I really am, chooses. So this interface between the mind and the world that I call Doug really doesn't exist except as a figment of the imagination of that mind that I really am. So rather than use Doug as an interference and go, well, I asked Jesus for help as Doug, but the mind's got to decide if it's really going to listen to Jesus or not, is a way of not taking responsibility for Doug being a mind. And I'm not subtly criticizing you for that interface. I do the same thing, and so does everyone else.
But
we do it because we're afraid of not being Lillian, afraid of not being Doug, because I don't know what it means to be a mind. I know what it means to be a Doug. I have lots of experience with Doug. I have very little experience with myself as a mind, except that now I've done enough choosing, enough different times, and in that little example I just gave you in traffic, of mischoosing, to recognize that I, as a figure in the dream, seem to experience the effects of that mischoice. So I want to get back to making the right choice at the level of mind. And the motivation to do that comes from the pain that having not chosen that brings us. And I don't have to talk to you about that. All of us here are in tremendous pain all of the time. But our tolerance for pain is so great that we hardly even notice it most of the time. I mean, if you think about the way that you're sitting right now, you'll notice that you're uncomfortable. You'll probably have to move something, turn the other cheek, do something, you know. Because you're actually not fully comfortable at any given moment as a body in the world. But we're so used to being a body in the world that it's just gone to background for us. My wife is a body worker, a structural integrationist, and she works with people's structure all the time, and she helps me work with mine. And whenever I work with my structure, I notice how out of alignment I am. I'm totally unaware of it 99.999% of the time, until I look at a photograph of myself or I look at myself in a mirror. And then I realize I'm leaning forward, I'm leaning back, I'm standing on one side, I'm standing on the other side. And I'm doing all of that to try to adjust for comfort in my body, but it's never found. So our tolerance for pain is tremendous, but it's
not infinite. It's not infinite.
No, it's not infinite. And the Course points that out to us. And so what the Course is trying to do, what Jesus is trying to do in the Course, talking to us, is sell us on the idea that we'd be better off listening to him than our ego. And he's right, and we're wrong. But we don't like that. We're so stubborn as egos, we'd rather go on suffering as a body than go to the difficulty of changing our mind, of taking responsibility for our mind. So again, the idea then is to use the world of dreams, which we think of as the world of reality, as the way to awaken. And the way that you do this, again, is to notice your reactions to everything else in the world. And your reactions tell you which teacher you're choosing, the teacher of kindness or the teacher of unkindness, the teacher of inclusion, the teacher of separation. You're listening to the voice of the Holy Spirit or the voice of Jesus, or you're listening to the voice of the ego or the voice of your selfish self. And which voice you're choosing determines what reaction you're having. So if you're having any form of an unpleasant reaction to anyone, whether you think this is not all right the way this person is acting, or I don't like the way the weather is, or I don't like the score to this ball game, or whatever you're thinking and you're having an unpleasant reaction to it, a negative reaction to it, you know that you've chosen the ego. You're choosing the teacher of unkindness, because you're experiencing unkindness. So your reaction always tells you which teacher you're choosing. And if you find that you're choosing the wrong teacher, which if you're paying any attention at all, you will find all the time that you're choosing the wrong teacher, most all of the time, then what you simply want to do is not reprimand yourself, but go, oh, this, I don't like this experience, so I don't like this teacher. I want to choose the other teacher so I can have the other experience. It's just straight-ahead common sense. Why? Why would you go on hurting yourself if you see that it's you that's hurting yourself? And I assure you that it's always and only you who is hurting yourself. You as a mind. Again, it seems to us in the world, as a body, that other bodies are impinging on us all of the time and that they're causing my body to suffer, either psychologically, usually psychologically, but sometimes physically. But if it's actually a dream, there is no body. There's only a mind. So again, think of your nighttime dreams. Think of somebody punching you on the arm in your nighttime dream, and it hurts. They hit you hard in your nighttime dream. So your dream body tells you somebody just punched you and that you're hurt. But there is no dream body. There's only the mind dreaming your body, dreaming another body that has a fist that's just punched you and now is dreaming pain. The same thing's going on in this world, in what we call the waking world, the waking dream. It seems to us that other bodies are doing it, but it's the mind that's doing it. And again, we're not asked to skip steps here. So when somebody punches you on the arm in the world, you don't want to go, oh, I'm not really a body, I'm a mind. That hardly hurts at all, except for the lump and the bruise and the abrasion there. What you want to do is realize that I, as a dreamer, wanted to be impinged upon by somebody that seems to be outside of my mind so that I could seem to be at effect here, that it's not my fault that I'm hurt, that I didn't choose the pain, this other person inflicted it on me, this disease, this microbe inflicted it on me, this cancer inflicted it on me, this broken leg inflicted it on me. We want the power to seem to rest outside of our minds so that we don't have to take responsibility for it. So when you're suffering pain, supposedly at somebody else's hands, whether it's another person or a malevolent microbe, when you're suffering pain in your body, you don't want to skip steps. The Course is not against what it calls magic, which is dealing with the pain at the level of form in the world. Take an aspirin, go see a doctor, have surgery, put on a splint, get a cast. Have the dentist fill your tooth. Do whatever you do at the level of form in the world. But meantime, at the level of mind, practice what the Course calls forgiveness, which is recognizing that I'm not upset about what's out there, this lump on my arm. I'm upset about the interpretation of it, which is that I'm a body which has been impinged upon unfairly, and it's not my fault. And so what you want to do is change your interpretation from one of victimhood to one of recognizing that you're the where all of the power in the universe is vested. And again, you don't want to do this in some silly way. And in a one-hour class, I don't have enough time to walk through all of that with you. But the Course certainly has walked us all through this many, many times in many, many ways. And so I give you the thumbnail sketch of the walk. So it's just a few minutes before noon, so I just want to stop and ask if there are any questions before I conclude here. Yes?
I was listening to what you said, and I heard you say that at the very end, like, the Course doesn't work in magic. Like, if you want to work and form the body, like, if you don't want to ignore, like, something that's wrong with you, like, you want to go to the doctor. What about in terms of, like, an abusive situation, like, relationship? And my question is, the Course is encouraging you not to leave someone, like, in pain or in stress. So you want to, like, help that person, but what if they're not capable of understanding enough in their own way, and so it's an unhealthy situation for maybe me to be in.
Right.
So how does...
What I usually say to folks about this kind of thing is that what you want to do is attend to yourself first, because you can't be helpful to somebody else while you're in a state of fear. So if you're being abused in some way, psychologically or physically, you can't help this other person while you're in a state of fear. And so what you want to do is recognize first that you're in a state of fear, and that fear is coming from the mind, and so that mind has chosen the wrong teacher. And so what you want to do is choose whatever symbol in the mind stands for not the ego for you, for not selfishness, for inclusion. Whether that's Jesus or the Holy Spirit or God or love or a dove or a ray of light, whatever symbol, you want to go to that in your mind. I often say go to your right mind, the home of love, where the memory of God resides. You want to get in touch with that right mind, and get yourself centered there, and then act from there. So let love be your guide about whether you stay or whether you go, whether you say something to this other person or whether you say nothing of what you do. And you want to be kind to yourself first and foremost, and then extend that kindness outward. So you want to choose love inside yourself first and kindness for yourself inside yourself first. And that will then just naturally extend in the most harmonious way outward. What that will look like, I would have no way of knowing. It'll be different for each person in each circumstance. But if you're truly listening to the voice of love, then what you do will be loving no matter what it looks like in the world. It might be leaving and not saying anything, or it might be sitting down and talking with this person, or it might be some other form that I would never even dream of. But you want to find love, you want to find your own center in your own right mind first, and let that be your guide for what you do. So the first thing that you do is not do anything but change your mind. And that is by allowing yourself to recognize that you're in a state of fear already, and that the correction for that is to choose love instead of fear, because those are the two choices. So, again, in conclusion, let me just say that the world that you live in, the world that we live in, this world of dreams, is the royal road back to your mind. And it's by noticing your own reactions, and primarily by noticing your own egoic reactions to everything, that you allow yourself to be corrected. So you notice first that you've made a mistake, and that you don't want to justify this mistake and keep carrying it forward. You want to allow it to be corrected. And you want to allow it to be corrected by the teacher that knows the correction. And the primary symbols, again, that the Course uses are Jesus or the Holy Spirit. But those are just symbols. Choose any symbol that works for you. And that's how it works. You use the dream to awaken from the dream rather than to keep yourself asleep.
Well, I know when I first started the course, I would think that when I asked the Holy Spirit for help, I would give him some options. And I think once I realized that, no, you just go for the truth. You don't give him option. Now, should I do this or should I do that?
Right.
So that was one thing for my in my own experience that I had to really realize, no, don't be doing that.
That's I'm glad you brought that. It's a really important point. Ken Wadnick, who is my teacher, who I often quote, says that Jesus is the maestro. He's the one keeping the rhythm with the baton. And we're always going up and snatching the baton out of his hand and going, is it this or is it this or is it this? You know, and it might not be any of those. He's the one that is the maestro, not us. So you don't want to ask him, do I do A, B, or C? You want to say, what do I need to learn from you? What is the lesson for me here now?
Thank you, Doug. It's wonderful.
Very nice.